9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I think that is fair
as
to
I say. Hands to kiss and babies to shake.
No, I think my record speaks for itself.
That's a really good question.
Hello and welcome to the Politically Speaking Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio. Special shout out to Aaron for our new, brand new theme music.
That's impressive.
Very impressive. We're very high quality here. Joining me in studio in St. Louis is...
Joe Manis.
Our special guest host...
Rachel Lippman.
And our very special guest this afternoon...
Jennifer Joyce.
The circuit attorney of St. Louis. I almost said prosecuting attorney. If I think I said that, I would have been zapped down by lightning.
That's right. Both are accurate. Both are accurate.
Yeah, but actually, prosecuting attorney is the official title for Bob McCullough.
He's the county prosecutor.
Right.
And that's why I can't be a county prosecutor, because I don't have a county.
Yes. Not yet, at least.
Well, the city of St. Louis is considered its own county.
Right.
But we're not here to talk about that issue. Thank you very much
for joining. It's just not named a county.
Yeah. Thank you.
Half hour later.
We are off to a great start here with the theme music, Gareth. First of all, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. We're kind of rolling through the list of citywide officials here on this show. I think we only have two or three left at this point. Mavis Thompson and Gregory FX Daly.
And the mayor is clamoring for a repeat. So.
Yeah, so we're having that. But, you know, this is, I think, our first time we've had a prosecuting attorney of any sort on this show.
Really?
I think so. We've probably had people who used to be prosecutors who are, you know, assistants attorney generals or something like that, but never the person.
We've had McCaskill on, but I know she's no longer a prosecutor.
Right.
She's a U.S. senator.
It's kind of like the priesthood. You know, you're always really, in some respects, a prosecutor.
So, you know, before we get into you and your political biography, just give us a little bit of a sense of what you do as circuit attorney and what your job is.
And your background, the fact that you grew up in St. Louis.
Yes. I grew up in St. Louis. I'm a lifelong resident. You know, for those who navigate by parish, I'm from St. Joan of Arc. Grew up kind of by Trattoria Marcella and Pernod and Watson
in
area.
The 23rd Ward?
In the glorious 23rd Ward.
Yeah, the mayor's home ward back in the day.
Well,
the mayor's
home ward. You're close to the best ward in the city, the 16th Ward, but, you know, I know that the 16th Ward and the 23rd Ward have a rivalry together.
As an citywide elected official, I love all wards.
Yes.
So I don't take one over the other.
Yes. Although your parents have in fact, that's how I first got to know you. I covered your mother.
Right. My parents were both aldermen of the 23rd Ward. My dad passed away when I was 10, and he was an alderman back in the day and ran for president of the board, was unsuccessful in the primary, and that was when Badaracco got elected.
So that was like 1968,
yeah, right around there. And I was pretty little, but I remember that. And then he died in office. And at the time, my mom, who was very sharp, decided she wanted to run for 23rd Ward Alderman, and she went to speak to the committee people, Francis Lee, the elder, and they basically told her that she needed to stay home with her four kids and that this was no place for a woman. And my mom was a brilliant lady, and she decided that she was going to run as an independent. And so her slogan was, "Look for me in column 3." And she came within just a handful of votes away from the officially endorsed Democratic candidate. And so that individual who won then, actually for whatever reason, I think health reasons, only served for a short period of time. And then Francis Slay came to my mom that time. She didn't have to go to him and said, "Will you be our candidate?" And so then she was the alderman for the 23rd Ward for many years until she died in 1985.
Yeah, and I knew her, covered her when I was covering the Board of Alderman back in the day before a couple of these people were alive. And one of the things neat about Nellie and Joyce was she was one of those people you could go to and say, "What just happened?" And she would explain to you this, and this, and here's what's going on behind the scenes. Or she'd collar you and say, "Now you need to know this. This is what's going on with this."
Yeah, she's very smart. And I actually have a little clock on my desk that Sharon Carpenter gave me when I first got elected that says WWND, stands for "What Would Nellie Do?" And when I get in a jam, I tend to look at
Sharon Sharon Carpenter, one of the best guests we've had on Politically Speaking. No snark there.
So anyway, I went to DeBerg. I know we have to get into DeBerg high schools here.
Mandatory.
That's right.
Also, Steve Stenger went to DeBerg as
a
well.
A lot of people went to DeBerg. The Southside Rapist went to DeBerg. I mean, we cover the spectrum.
Yeah, and I live like 5 feet away from DeBerg at this point, so my one-year-old son has a 50% chance of going there at this point.
So good, you school. Went to SLU Law School?
I went to SLU undergrad. I have a business degree, and then I went to St. Louis U Law School as well, mm-hmm. and started out my legal career at a large law firm downtown, which is now merged into Hush. And I did big silk-socking law firm corporate law. Interesting trivia piece is that starting her legal career on the exact same day as me in the office next to me was Catherine Hanaway. Mm-hmm. And Catherine and I remain very close friends, although we can never talk about politics, obviously. But fortunately, it's a big world and there's lots to talk about. Yeah. But she's a dear friend.
I'm sure she could talk about the high stakes litigation she did when she was U.S. attorney and compare it to the high stake litigation you did when you were circuit
yes.
attorney.
Yes, well, and that was actually a tremendous amount of fun in our relationship was when she was U.S. attorney and I was circuit attorney. And for once, our career paths aligned again, and we enjoyed that a lot.
So you've been circuit attorney for 15 years, so that's among the longer.
Yes.
In the city's history.
If I finish this term, and God willing, that's my goal, I will be the longest serving circuit attorney.
Because
George Peach made it two-thirds of the way through his fourth
until,
term.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So at this stage, what do you see as some of the key issues that you're dealing with in your office?
Well, the biggest issue that we are so completely focused on right now is gun violence in the city of St. Louis. And I've been sounding the alarm about this for a few years now. We have an unacceptably high level of gun violence in St. Louis. And we are 24/7 working on that problem right now. We've traveled around the country, studied jurisdictions where they've actually been able to reduce their gun violence, and looked for prosecutorial initiatives that reduce gun violence. And we've gotten some really good ideas, and we're implementing them, and I think it's going to have a positive effect.
Where are some of the other players in this game? Obviously, the prosecutor only has so much they can do. What are some of the other players in the game going to have to do? Judges, police officers, community members, in order to do this?
Well, I think that the police are doing everything they can. I'm a big fan of Chief Dotson. I think I've seen many chiefs in my tenure, and I think he is certainly the best. He is doing an excellent job. They're working on their hotspot policing. They have all kinds of different initiatives going on. The police have a challenge. They have to rebuild trust with the community after all the Ferguson uproar that we had last year. The citizens absolutely have to get involved, and that is kind of my message that I'm preaching more and more these days, is that there is a role for every person in the city of St. Louis in reducing gun violence. And if you don't know what your role is, call me. I will tell you what your role is. And there's many different ways to contribute, but it's going to take everybody to contribute to move the needle on gun violence. And the judges, I hope that they can see that gun violence is an epidemic in St. Louis. It's a very serious situation that we're facing. There is a higher murder rate in this city than in a war zone. We need to take this seriously and have appropriate outcomes.
Why do you think that the gun violence rate in St. Louis is so high?
It's a complicated problem. Okay, people always want to know one thing that's causing it, and thereby one thing can solve it. It's an extremely complicated problem, and it probably goes back 50 years, and we don't have time to go into all the, you know, housing policies in the United States 50 years ago and how they created areas of our community that are disadvantaged economically. And, there's a lot of forces at play. There's poverty, there's poor schools, there's lack of mentorship, all kinds of things. And that's why the citizens have such a role to play, because that's the part that law enforcement can't address, is interceding in the lives of young people so that they don't pick up a gun and they don't become criminals.
Now, has some of the actions in Jefferson City or at the ballot box lately either helped or hurt the city's effort to fight gun violence?
Well, Amendment 5 is a disaster. I mean, that was just inexplicably bad thing that happened in the state. And hopefully, you know, there are some people that say that Amendment 5 cannot possibly be fixed because it's so incredibly flawed. I'm hopeful that they can do a legislative fix of it, and I know there's people working on it right now.
Well, I actually saw Attorney General Chris Coster today, and one of the things, I know that there's been a lot of criticism of Senator Schaefer because he handled that bill, and probably appropriately so because he was involved in it.
Well, Coster supported it,
but that was what I was going
to
say.
Well, although first, we need to explain to our listeners what Amendment 5 is. Amendment 5, on the surface, was to expand gun rights in Missouri, but among other things, critics say that it's basically allowed felons to keep their guns.
Well, it has.
Yeah, so I asked Coster about this today, and you know, this is what he said about the idea of felons being able to get guns.
I actually think, given the court's makeup and looking at other rulings that they've had on this issue, that it is more likely than not that they will say that the existing laws related to felons in possession that predate the adoption of the amendment will stand. But those 7 votes are the ones that will decide it ultimately.
Now, I'm guessing that you and Jackson County Prosecutor Gene Peters Baker have a difference of opinion from the Attorney General. Is that fair to say?
Yes, we do. And neither one of us is running for statewide office, so we probably have a lot more latitude in saying what the truth is on this. And the truth is that Amendment 5 did nothing to expand lawful gun owners' rights. It did nothing to increase the rights of people. The ballot language was incredibly misleading. And unfortunately, the timing of it was such that it could not be changed. And as a result, it has already nullified, for all practical purposes, a felon in possession law in my circuit. We have cases dismissed because of Amendment 5 now. We have someone who committed a felony, who has a gun, who cannot be prosecuted as a felon in possession because of Amendment 5. And I know Mr. Coster, and I think he's a very smart lawyer, and I have to believe that he can see that as well.
Well, actually, as a follow-up, why he supported Amendment 5, because before it ended up passing, there were some prominent Democrats like yourself, like Sam Dotson, like Gene Peters Baker, which were sounding alarm bells. But Attorney General Coster not only defended the ballot language, but he also explicitly politically endorsed Amendment 5.
Now, we need to make clear, Attorney General Chris Coster is a Democrat running for governor in 2016.
Yes, but this is what he said when I asked him about why he supported it.
The people of the state of Missouri are very strongly supportive of Second Amendment. It is a cultural and historic aspect of the people of our state. And, you know, coming up in the political world, while I was born and raised here in St. Louis, I came up and learned politics in rural Missouri, representing people and families there, and adopted a lot of those values myself.
So what's your response to that?
Well, I am a Chris Coster fan, make no mistake, but that's ridiculous. It does nothing to preserve people's Second Amendment rights. People's Second Amendment rights in the state of Missouri are unchanged in any way by Amendment 5. They were strong to begin with, they're strong now. Amendment 5 was something that sounded good. It was a feel-good thing. And it was worded in such a way that it made people think, wow, if I don't vote for this, then I'm going to be losing something. And that's completely false. It did nothing to expand rights for anybody except criminals.
How is losing felon in possession charges, for all intents and purposes right now, making the job you have to do of putting people behind bars harder now?
Well, as I said, gun violence is a huge issue in St. Louis. We had 159 murders last year. 138 of those were due to gun violence. Of those, about 60% were individuals under 25. I mean, people are shooting at each other left and right. The vast majority of the people who are being killed because of gun violence are the African-American community. They are bearing a disproportionate burden here in terms of gun violence. And it is, you know, common sense that if you have someone who's a convicted felon, you know, somebody who's robbed somebody in the past, somebody who has molested a child in the past, somebody who's domestic violence stalking or a big drug dealer, you don't want that person carrying a gun. That person has demonstrated that they're willing to break the law, they're willing to commit crimes, and it makes no sense to let them carry a gun. And our hands are tied in some respects now because of this. I say in some respects because some judges are still letting us go forward. But some judges, such as Judge Robert Durker, who's an Ashcroft appointee, about the most conservative judge in the state of Missouri, is the one that has said, sorry, Amendment 5 bars you, Jennifer, from bringing this charge.
Do you think, as the Attorney General mentioned, there may be some clarity through the Supreme Court case, or is there going to be this ambiguity through these lower circuits, as you kind of mentioned?
Here, my question would be, why the heck are we amending the Constitution to create no benefit for law-abiding people and then saying, Supreme Court, fix this? What in the world is that? I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. We cannot be cavalier with our gun laws. We just can't. I mean, if we're going to do constitutional amendments, and I don't even know why we're doing that, let's do a constitutional amendment about the state bird. You know, let's do something that isn't going to result in people being killed on the street. Amendment 5 was a disaster. It was a bad, bad law. And hopefully it gets fixed. I know people are working on it. I think, you know, some people would say it can't possibly be fixed. It's too bad.
Well, does this affect other people who are involved, like State Senator Kurt Schaefer, who's running for Missouri Attorney General, since he was basically the sponsor of this? I mean, could this possibly have political blowback beyond the fact that Koster supported it, but that Schaefer also helped create it?
You know, I don't know. I am much more of a prosecutor than a politician, so I would leave that to you guys. That's your area of expertise. I'm just a prosecutor. I care about public safety and saving people's lives and preventing gun violence, and this is a huge obstacle for us to overcome.
Well, I wanted to shift gears a little bit to kind of the post-Ferguson reality for you, because even though it happened in St. Louis County, I mean, I think it affects law enforcement in every part of the region.
Well, there were protests in the city of St. Louis because of another gun shooting.
I think that there were several police shootings here where a policeman shot and killed somebody.
At least three since Mike Brown.
And I mean, that would put you in the spotlight as well. Maybe not as brightly as McCullough, but still, I'm kind of curious what you feel the lay of the land is a few months after the grand jury decision and kind of after the last few months, if you're thinking of your job a little bit differently than before, whether you're not, basically. I'm curious to hear what you've learned from the last few months.
Well, the whole procedure where we review the police shootings is newly enacted. It's been in the planning stages for a long time, years, but it's newly enacted post-Ferguson. So we are in the process of wrapping up our first investigation under that new process. We reviewed the first case that we received, the Bondurant Myers case. And, you know, it's taking some time because we really want to achieve different goals. We want to make sure that we've answered all the questions of the community, that we've thoroughly and independently investigated every aspect of the case, and have a way to communicate to the public what our findings were and why. So we are in the process of, we're coming down the home stretch on that, and then we will move into the other ones. It's in some respects things are different, but in some respects they're the same as they ever were. The job of a prosecutor is to gather evidence and make a determination whether someone has committed a crime. Has a crime been committed, and who committed the crime? That is the job of a prosecutor, and it was before Ferguson, and it is now. What's different now is that these cases have there's a lot of unrest in the community with respect to the actions of law enforcement. And so it's very, very important that the community have confidence that this investigation is being conducted properly.
And that was going to be my next question, because you mentioned the trust of the community. And I'm going to play a clip here that's from St. Louis County, and I want to just make that clear. But I think it kind of exemplifies why there may be distrust towards law enforcement. I'll just set it up a little bit. This man's name is Ted Kiles. He originally lived in Pagedale for a while. And he was telling one of our reporters, Maria Altman, back in August, his experience after being pulled over by a Pagedale officer because he was mistaken as a bank robber for a bank robbery in Afton.
Now, this guy had a gun drawn, okay? So now it came over the wire that they had caught the guy. I could have been killed and taken away from my family because of something like this. So I know it happens. You know, a lot of people don't think that stuff like this can happen.
So the reason I played that clip is after the Michael Brown shooting, we talked with a lot of people who had that type of experience with the police, and they were mainly African Americans. And even though the Michael Brown situation has been investigated by county and federal, and Darren Wilson has not been charged with anything, mm-hmm. I mean, there's still been a lot of people who come forward and said maybe it wasn't a situation where they were shot by police officers, but they were disrespected or really intimidated in that type of situation. So given that, and I'm sure you could find people in the city of St. Louis who've had that experience, how do you rebuild trust?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing new about that. I mean, I've been a prosecutor for over 20 years, and every time we pick a jury in the city of St. Louis, we hear those things. You know, there are a lot of people who are very, very reasonable people who have beliefs about police officers stemming from a bad interaction that they had. I know Chief Dotson is aware of that, and I know he's concerned about it, and he is the one that's primarily in charge of this effort of training police officers and rebuilding the trust of the community. I've got to say that I am very troubled when I see scenes like what happened in South Carolina. I'm very, very troubled by the case in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I think that, you know, sometimes it turns out that the police officer is in the wrong and they need to be held accountable for their actions. Sometimes it's not. It's the role of the prosecutor to gather evidence and expertly analyze and review that evidence and make a decision as to whether a prosecution should go forward.
You said that you've always seen in jury questioning and on any case that there's been a mistrust of police officers. Was there any way mm-hmm. that like looked different after Michael Brown's shooting or after the grand jury decision to get taken to a new level in
yes.
any way?
Yes, it did. The city of St. Louis, being a completely urban jurisdiction, has always had a segment of the population that's suspicious of law enforcement. That's true in any urban jurisdiction. But after the Ferguson decision, we had a week or two where we lost all of our cases. We got not guilties across the board. And very top, experienced, excellent, virtuoso prosecutors getting a not guilty for the first time in years. I can only attribute that to attitudes that people came in with because of Ferguson. And then the same thing happened to a little bit lesser extent when the grand jury decision was announced. Fortunately, we're back to normal now. And I recently was at a conference, and Bob McCullough was there, and we were talking about this. And he did not have anything of that nature happen in his jurisdiction, which I thought was ironic. But it's a reflection of the different population in St. Louis County versus St. Louis City that he sneezes, but we catch the cold.
Yeah, I have to ask because, you know, Bob McCullough has been the prosecutor of St. Louis County since, what, 1991 at this
yes.
point? And before the Michael Brown situation, I mean, he was almost universally held in very high regard, both mm-hmm. politically and I think as a prosecutor. Now, after Michael Brown's situation, I'm sure there's a lot of people that still like him and still support him.
Yes.
But he has a lot more detractors now. What do you kind of make of how he dealt with that crush of, you know, worldwide attention? And how do you think he kind of handled going through that decision from a distance? Obviously, you weren't involved in it, but just kind of what was your take of how he handled that situation?
Well, I have a lot of respect for how Bob handled the situation. I think that he is extremely principled in how he handled it. I know a lot of people were clamoring that he step aside, and he felt that he did not have a conflict. And I see his point. You know, I mean, if he has a conflict because his father was a police officer years ago, was killed in the line of duty, then there's a lot of other cases that he shouldn't be a prosecutor at all. You know, and theoretically, every case he prosecutes, he has police officer witnesses. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I get his argument that he didn't have a conflict. And whether he stepped aside or not was his decision and his decision alone. And I thought that it was very principled of him to stick by his decision in that, despite the clamor. But if you know Bob McCullough, I mean, he's not the type to respond to clamor. I don't know how to describe
him. I think Joe has known him for a long time. I think that
that's definitely true. And I said the interviews that I had with him that during all this, he was kind of like that. And
yeah, I mean, he's very confident. he knows that he's right on the law there, and it's up to him to decide what he wants to do, and he made his decision. Whether I would make the same decision in that circumstance, I don't know.
Yeah, because you didn't know the evidence. But I have to just note, I mean, St. Louis County has to be the largest and have the most resources out of any prosecuting attorney, maybe next to Jackson County.
I don't know if they have the most resources.
But I was trying to say it's a very sophisticated prosecutorial office.
Yes.
That's all I was trying to say.
I would say the three... We have more cases than anybody.
Correct.
By a long shot. But the three most well-resourced offices is my office, St. Louis County, and Jackson County.
Yeah.
And he's a very experienced prosecutor, as were the prosecutors in the grand jury. So
let's kind of segue into another issue that may be close to more journalists' heart. But in the midst of all this, during some of the protests, you had subpoenaed for some either video or records of...
Let's have Rachel explain this.
It was related to a hearing held on the Civilian Oversight Board. Some kind of scuffle broke out. I didn't see what happened leading up to this, but a scuffle broke out between supporters of the bill and opponents. Mm-hmm. The business manager for the Police Officers Association, Jeff Rorta, is in the center of this melee, and it essentially
a previous guest on our podcast.
Previous guest on the podcast.
Former Democratic state representative from Jeffco, but
yes.
Continue.
And there, you know, a lot of media there, including myself. And a couple days later, a subpoena shows up for the station for some of the material that we'd gathered reporting that night, both on the committee hearing and then on what had happened in the midst of the committee hearing. So that's kind of the background to this conversation.
And I believe the subpoena is no longer, dropped eventually.
Correct. So, and it was not directed at any reporter in particular. It was to the station. I happened to be the one there that night.
So with that backdrop,
okay,
what kind of explain the situation?
Well, it was dropped because you guys didn't have any response to it. You didn't have any photographs or videos, so we don't make you come down to court to tell the judge you don't have photographs or video.
Right.
That's why it was dropped. And we did amend it. We originally asked, we sent our standard form, which also asked for notes, and we didn't necessarily need your notes. We just wanted any photos. Basically, I mean, before I came down here today, I spent some time talking with a woman who is here in court today to testify. She's a victim of a very vicious, very brutal rape. I can't even discuss the facts on this public airway.
Sure.
She's terrified that the defendant, if he's not convicted, is going to kill her. And when I was speaking to her about it, she had tears in her eyes and she was physically shaking. But she was there because she's terrified that he is going to rape somebody else, and maybe a child. And this woman has maybe an eighth grade education. She's not fancy. She's just a plain, ordinary person who has been victimized. She showed tremendous courage coming forward to make sure that the system worked. And I see that all the time, people who literally risk their lives to make sure that investigations and prosecutions are true and proper and correct. And I expect that from every citizen, and journalists are no exception to that whatsoever. And particularly, some would say, journalists who tend to criticize the criminal justice system should be the first people that want to make sure that the criminal justice system works well. In this case, we had a melee at City Hall. And the case is still pending, so I can't get too much into the details of it. But if you recall, a couple of weeks earlier, I had prosecuted some protesters for shoving someone mm-hmm. at City Hall. There was video of that. I prosecuted one young man who's on the Ferguson Commission. And a lot of people had outcry, you shouldn't prosecute him because he's on the Ferguson Commission. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you know what? He committed what looks to be a crime, so we're going forward. After the melee at City Hall, I got numerous calls that Mr. Rorta had pushed somebody. How can I prosecute a protester and not prosecute Mr. Rorta? I have to prosecute both of them because I really don't care what you do for a living. If mm-hmm. you commit a crime in my jurisdiction, I'm going to prosecute it. Mm-hmm. Subpoenas are an important tool that prosecutors use to gather evidence. Mm-hmm. We send out subpoenas to media outlets weekly. And we've been doing that for as long as I've been in the office. I have never had a media outlet have the kind of reaction that this one did. It was quite remarkable. We need information in order to make good charging decisions. That is all. And, you know, when you have, like, the Academy Awards, okay? Let's say George Clooney and his wife stand up there in front of the backdrop and all the paparazzi are taking their pictures. Mm-hmm. You know, this guy's picture is fungible with this guy's picture. If you get one of those pictures, you got a picture of the Clooneys at the Academy Award. In a melee, and I've been analyzing video as a prosecutor for 20 years, camera angle makes a huge difference as to what you can see.
Yeah.
And so the only way to tell whether or not a prosecution should result from that is to see every possible camera angle. I wasn't there. We've never subpoenaed KWMU before because we didn't think you guys did photographs. But I recently have seen that more and more on your website, and so we added you to the list of people that we subpoenaed. I guess what disappointed me the most, I mean, and you were called, Rachel, by Lauren Traeger, who said, you can expect this, this is coming over. I mean, we didn't just show up with the Gestapo and slam open the door. I mean, we let you know. You had no questions.
Sure.
You had no questions. What disappointed me the most about how the station reacted, though, was immediately there was a lot of outcry. There was no call to us to seek understanding or to have a conversation about it. An op-ed was published on the website here condemning this as, you know, tearing at the very Constitution. And only a couple of days later was there a call with some follow-up questions asking to seek understanding. Now, I didn't go to journalism school, but I did go to law school. And in law school, we're taught to understand the issue and seek clarity before you form an opinion and scream and yell about something. Mm-hmm. I did not see that happen here. The fact of the matter is, and I also stepped in the middle of Tony Messenger's quest to have a shield law. And as I said to you before we started today,
this is different from the shield law, which is
right.
why I haven't
I'm in favor done. Of a shield law. I have no problem with a shield law. I'm happy to provide him with another excuse to raise that issue, and we can do that over and over again. But there is no shield law in the United States of America that protects any journalist who has evidence of a crime being committed right in front of them mm-hmm. from a prosecutor who has to have that evidence to understand the case.
Now, can I just ask this question? Because this is just mm-hmm. going to be the devil's advocate
sure.
that is played. That especially, and again, it's separate from the shield law, but a lot of shield law advocates say that prosecutors should look elsewhere before going to a media outlet. Is this a situation where
we
the
did?
Only...
We absolutely okay. did. Yeah. But you know, in this unique situation, in a melee situation, mm-hmm. you can never know. You have to go to as many people as you possibly can, particularly with visual evidence. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we wanted with the notes is to find out who else was there. Well, we right. found out we knew some people who were there, and we could ask around, and we got to everybody who was there another way. Mm-hmm. So we withdrew the notes request.
Sure.
But as far as photographic evidence, mm-hmm. photographs and video, you can never say, okay, I've got these five photographs, now I've got enough in that particular situation.
Yeah, because
I'm going to charge someone unjustly.
Because just to kind of go off your just to go off your point, I watched like a live stream video of that situation. It was kind of unclear because it was cut at a point where I don't think you really saw enough time. Is that
right.
fair to say,
so
Rachel?
So probably, yeah. I mean, it was a good 2-3-4 minute
right.
scuffle, them trying to calm everyone down.
Right.
I think the event itself played out. The participating event played out maybe within 30 seconds, but it continued for a while before they got everyone out, and I'm sure things happened outside the room afterwards.
Well, I'm mostly concerned about the allegation that I have that there was an assault on the part of Jeff Arruda, that he pushed some woman, and it's my job to investigate that,
sure.
and it's my job to not charge someone wrongfully because I only took 1, 2, 3 pieces of evidence, and I decided I wasn't going to ask the media for their evidence. I mean, that's absurd. There is no law that protects you guys from that, and it's not the First Amendment. If you have evidence of a crime, I'm going to subpoena you, and in court, you're going to be ordered to give it to me. It's just as simple as that. And I heard one commentator on Don Marsh's show say, well, she was entitled to it, but there's a nice way to do it. I'm sorry. We are busy. We are not going to give you a calligraphy parchment subpoena. We called and let you know it was coming. We don't want the identity of Deep Throat. We don't want your sources. We want evidence in order to make a decision as to whether someone should be charged or not. And that is my job as a prosecutor, and I take that very, very seriously.
Was one of your contentions that the fact that it was at a public event as opposed to, like, in somebody's house?
Absolutely. It wasn't a confidential source. Shield laws protect confidential
right,
sources.
Exactly, yeah.
This was not a confidential source by any stretch of the imagination, but the the reaction from this station and the op-ed and all the screaming and yelling, it made it sound like we were asking for confidential sources. We did nothing of the kind, and a simple phone call to discuss this would have clarified all of that. In the end, you didn't have any evidence, and we're done.
But we're glad you provided your perspective to us, because I think it's important for you to explain.
I'm glad you asked me.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad too.
Well, hey.
You know,
that's what the show is all about.
I think it makes for a more interesting show that way.
Yes.
But let's kind of shift quickly to, do I have to say the politically part of politically speaking? I just did. So
didn't have to though.
I hate myself sometimes. So you're going to be up for re-election next
2016,
year.
2016.
And you're planning to run for re-election.
That's the plan.
That would be a fifth term. Is that correct?
Right.
So you're not running for attorney general.
I'm not. I'm supporting Scott Sifton.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. Why have you decided to choose Sifton over Zimmerman in that instance?
I don't really know Mr. Zimmerman that well. He seems like a really sharp guy and a good guy, and I know a lot of people think really highly of him. I just have known Scott for a long time. We both are from the same law firm. He interned in the circuit attorney's office. He regularly will call me during session when he has a question about a particular law. I mean, he seems very, very focused on public safety, which is what I am, you know, obviously totally focused on myself. So I just think he's a natural for that job. His candidacy makes sense to me.
Now, but your name was on a lot of Democratic lists. I mean, they were still trying to figure out who might run, who they would encourage to run. Mm-hmm. What prompted you not to run, and are you looking at running for anything else down the road?
Well, I mean, the reason that I am a politician is because I love the work that I do as circuit attorney, and I love the circuit attorney's office. When I was in private practice, I used to help people fight over money, and that was good, but it in no way was as satisfying as helping people pursue justice and getting justice and making sure that these really important decisions are made to the best possible ability of everybody concerned. And that is my passion and that is my love. I have to be a politician to have that job, but I don't have that job because I want to be a politician and run for other offices. So never say never, but I love my job.
If the mayor runs for another term, would you support him in his fifth term endeavors at this point?
I think Mayor Slay is doing an excellent job. It's impossible to say what you would do hypothetically, but I think he's been a great mayor.
Do you think, though, that like four terms is already unprecedented? We call it the unprecedented fourth term, jokingly, but do you think that at five terms there might be a little bit of Slay fatigue and, you know, he may face a even stronger opponent next time?
Well, I think, I don't know who said it, but being mayor is you die a death of 1,000 cuts. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty remarkable that he has lasted as long as he has. And it'll be interesting to see because he's got, he's getting new people in key leadership positions there. And I think that's good. I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see.
Now, you've known the mayor since what, since you were kids?
Yes.
And if I recall right, hadn't he been supportive when you first ran?
Sure. He's always been supportive of me.
But it's interesting, your take on your job. It reminds me a lot of what Bob McCullough has told me.
Exactly. You don't see him running for a higher office.
Because, you know, people thought he was like a county executive candidate after Buzz Westfall passed away, and he decided not to.
There was a lot of pressure on him.
If he decided to have done that, he would probably still be county executive right now, given how popular he was.
Yes.
But he decided not to do that because he wants to be a prosecutor.
Here's the secret. It's a great job. If you're called to be a prosecutor, and it's a calling, this is a fantastic job. I can't think of a better, greater honor than to do this work. And what we've seen in the last year in this community is this work is so important to all different aspects of society. And it's a great job. And I can understand why Bob wouldn't run for anything else.
Is there one thing you want to say to the General Assembly? Like in one sentence, what you hope they do the next month, next 3 weeks?
You know, stop amending the Constitution.
Well, I'm sure you and Bob.
And what, fix Amendment 5, or can they even?
I'm optimistic about it. Some people think they can't, but I'm hoping that they do, and I know there's conversations. And I'm sure everybody has noble intent here, but if they're passing laws that impact on law and order and the ability of police and prosecutors to do their work, they need to consult with police and prosecutors about it. That would be my request, that they do that. And I'm always available to talk to anybody.
Very good. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for a lively and awesome discussion. And being
awesome.
And being the first guest shows. With our new theme song. To close this out, you can read all of our stories at stlpublicradio.org and follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Joe on Twitter at
Jay Manis. That's JMANNIES.
You can follow Rachel on Twitter at
R Lipman, 2 P's, 2 N's.
And can we follow you on Twitter?
We have two. We have the official STLCAO at Twitter, and then my personal account is Jennifer Joyce CA.
Which has generated some controversy
yes,
from time to time.
Yes. Mainly, I was one of the first prosecutors on Twitter.
And mainly because you posted a picture once of a car completely stuck with sticky notes.
Yes.
That was pretty controversial then. Thank you very much, and until next week, thank you very much for listening. Until then, so long. Yeah.